This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is Friday, which means it's time for our Week in Review. Stories this week of diving in or diving over a cliff, as doctors Shira Doron and Ashish Jha tell us. After a huge spike in cases thanks to Omicron, the numbers are seriously plunging.
7 days worth of going down. That's pretty real.
And there's reason to be cautiously optimistic for the future.
When the next surge comes, we'll be ready.
Meanwhile, Democrats arguably threw themselves off the cliff this week, charging forward with the debate in the Senate over voting rights legislation, already knowing the outcome.
Senate Democrats are under no illusion that we face difficult odds.
On this vote, the yeas are 49, the nays are 51.
Senator Chuck Schumer and Vice President Kamala Harris, they are ultimately Democrats, couldn't convince two of their own to change filibuster rules to force it through, including Senator Joe Manchin.
But rules, a little bit we have left that maybe makes us take pause before we jump off of that bridge. We better be careful what we're doing.
We'll feel repercussions back here, including in the race for Secretary of the Commonwealth. But we will start with someone who has been giving us a cliffhanger for months.
I didn't grow up wanting to be a politician. I never imagined it.
She's running. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey dives into the governor's race.
She's got the organization. She's got the supporters. And she knows what it takes to win a big race like this.
That is what Marianne Marsh thinks. What do you think? We are going to talk about all of it with our expert panel, starting with the governor's race. What do you make of AG Healey jumping in? Are you glad to see her running? Are you worried about a heated Democratic primary splintering the party, three candidates in the race right now? And what does all this mean for Republican frontrunner, former state representative Jeff Deal? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined this week by former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, now CEO of Verdant Medical. Tito, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, now the president and executive director of Learn Launch. Governor Swift, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about this Maura Healey entrance into the race. Tito Jackson, any surprise anywhere at all in this announcement?
Ozark came out today. That might have been the only surprise when it comes to this this piece. I think it was long awaited. I think people need to go back and understand who and what Maura Healey is. She's a fighter. She was an underdog when she first ran for the role that she's in. She's a baller. And I believe that she's going to run a strong campaign. She has raised the dough to be able to start day one with a very real statewide organization. But I also think, money doesn't say it all. I should not have been able to get 35% with 350,000 versus 5.2 million when I ran for mayor. But the real piece here is, I think, a robust and real Democratic primary that debates the issues is a good thing. This shouldn't be about trying to wash other folks out of the race. This should be about a robust conversation about what people want, need, and deserve in these difficult economic, social, mental health, education times.
So, Tito Jackson, well taken there that this is about debate and discussion. You did bring up the money. I do want to come back to that for just a second. Governor Swift, according to Politico, $207,000 in fundraising in the first 24 hours. I almost kind of just want to turn to you and say, is that a lot? Put that in context for us.
So,
if this is for Governor Swift, go ahead, Governor Swift.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really healthy haul. Folks have to remember we have relatively low limits on what can be donated in Massachusetts. And frankly, I think it's also relative, right? It's very expensive to run for governor. It's more expensive depending on who you're running against and whether or not you have a competitive primary. So yes, I think that is a very healthy funding haul, but I think to date we don't have a self-funding, really wealthy candidate, and so fundraising becomes even more important and allows all of these folks to be competitive.
So in this competitive primary question, I want to play a little sound of former Boston mayor and now Labor Secretary Marty Walsh on CNN last night.
It was an honor to be mentioned as a governor. I love Massachusetts. I love my city of Boston, but I'm serving the people of the United States of America right now.
So let's just presume for a second, Tito Jackson, and this is a big presumption, but let's presume for just a moment that the Democratic field is now fixed. So you have three major candidates. You have Attorney General Maura Healey. You have Harvard Professor Danielle Allen, State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz. Do you have the range in the race to have the debates you want to see leading into a Democratic primary?
I absolutely. First off, I think it's notable. A couple pieces that there's three women on the Democratic side to choose from. I also think it is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And when Maura Healey first ran, the fact that she was the first LGBTQIA statewide candidate. I also think it's notable that didn't even get a mention, and that's and how much that is actually progress. I do believe we have an opportunity to have the range of conversations that are needed to make sure that the state comes back. And
oops, we lost Tito Jackson there. We will pick him back up. I do want to hear the rest of that point. While we are waiting to get him back, former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, I'm thinking about this, you know, contested primary. Do we get the debate that we want? Three fairly progressive candidates in the race on the the Democratic side. Here is former state representative and Republican candidate for governor now, Jeff Diehl, who says he believes that Healey actually gives him a clearer shot at victory.
He's the Democrat. He's going to produce a candidate who has got a radically progressive agenda of more government control.
And so the first part of what he said there guarantees that the Democratic primary produces a radically progressive agenda. Do you buy that, Governor Swift?
So I think it's interesting. If you look at General Healey's announcement, she did not tack far to the left. And between, you know, Danielle Allen and Senator Chang Diaz, I think that lane is fairly well filled. And so I think that I'm not saying that, you know, Maura Healey is a moderate, but for where the Democratic Party has been trending, I think she came out with a very balanced, more meat and potatoes, so that's an old-fashioned word, type approach to this race that will resonate beyond the very liberal base that you need, I would say, not as much in a primary as to get through the convention.
So 1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. Do we have a pool of candidates now for governor of Massachusetts? And I know it's early for a lot of people, but we're in it now. I mean, we are in the race now. Do you see representation out there that means the Commonwealth's in good shape? One way or another, is the kind of candidate you need to see in the mix? And if not, what are we missing? Again, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bringing Tito Jackson back in here. And Tito, we're still in the slipstream of that conversation about the debate and the issues. And do we have the representation across the field to put all the issues on the table now?
I think we absolutely do. As Governor Swift noted, we have the middle filled, and we obviously have the left flank there. I think the people of the state of Massachusetts, based on different regions and even the different socioeconomic strata right now, are closer than ever in terms of the very real things that they're dealing with. Everyone who has a child, regardless of how much money you have or not, has to deal with the possibility that they could end up back in the home, affecting their work schedule. Any individuals who just go out into the store are thinking about the issues of COVID, and we're all thinking about how we are going to survive economically. So I think we have an opportunity to start where we agree and then move into some of the issues that might be more far-flung. So I believe that this field is very strong, robust, and can hit all of the issues.
So staying with the field, Governor Swift, you said a couple of things, a couple threads I want to pick up on. One, emphasizing that you felt Maura Healey, at least in her launch, sounded a little bit more moderate, which it sounds like you think is important. You also made a mention that there's no sort of self-funded rich business person. There are a couple of other speculations going on the Republican side. Again, former state representative Jeff Diehl, who really very clearly is from the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party, has Donald Trump's endorsement. endorsement is in the race, but there's some speculation about everyone from former U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling to Rentham businessman Chris Doty. Do you see, you know, we elect Republican governors and we tend to kind of go on an 8-year swing. Is there room for another Republican gubernatorial candidate here who could really play?
So I definitely think that the field will, and I hope will, grow. I think that Jeff Diehl has a strong, record, and he's been a state representative. But I would remind people, and this is ancient history for some, in 1990, everybody thought that Steve Pearce, who was the House Minority Leader and a good friend of mine, would run away with the Massachusetts GOP nomination. And while he won the convention, obviously, he did not win the primary. Bill Weld won the primary. And I get we're in different times, but there are still a lot of sensible Republicans like me who are looking for candidates center-right. And I don't think one of those has emerged yet, who can govern in the model, frankly, that Governor Baker has governed in. I don't know why folks in my party are so upset to have an historically popular governor. And, you know, I would love for a female candidate to emerge so that we have two women eventually running against each other so we can throw the gender issues out the door like we were able to in the mayor's race.
So we do, and I'll note, Tito Jackson, you noted Maura Healey is an LGBTQIA candidate. We have three women candidates on the Democratic side, two women of color on the Democratic side, possibilities for lots of firsts there. One of the other dimensions that we looked at, we had a really interesting and fun conversation with former Massachusetts Attorney General Scott Harshbarger about this year, is actually how hard it is for attorneys general to translate their popularity in that office to the governor's office. And we had a couple of different thoughts from Scott on this. I want to share one about the difficulty in that translation.
When you're looking for governor, you are looking for something broader, something more human, if you will. You have to listen to this person for several years, and you're not always sure you want somebody up there who, if his attorney general maybe was lecturing you.
And, you know, to point out, Scott Harshbarger was the Democratic nominee for governor, lost in a race to then acting governor Paul Cellucci. More of a robust conversation there that we had with him about what makes you good in one role may not make you what people want in another. Do you think Maura Healey, if she were the Democratic nominee, could overcome that sort of curse of the attorney general?
I believe that, she is a competitor. She was a come from behind candidate when it came to her first run. She's been diligent in fighting for the people of the state of Massachusetts. And I don't believe, I believe that Maura Healey is going to run a campaign where she is not someone who she feels is anointed. I think she's going to get out there and meet people where they're at. And I think that's the Democratic candidate's style that wins. And we saw this from Governor Patrick, where you had organizers across the state of Massachusetts coming together, putting together organizing cards. I still have some of them in my house. You had an underdog in Governor Patrick, who became the first Black governor and the second Black governor post-Reconstruction. That's the type and style of campaign that I believe that you will see, not only from Maura Healey, but from Sonia Chang Diaz, as well as all of the other candidates who are in this mix on the Democratic side. That's how you have to win.
So, Jane Swift, party affiliation aside, you said a minute ago you're not sure why your party is upset with a historically popular Republican governor. We know the conversation about Charlie Baker has been he's kind of a mechanic. He's not a visionary. Does Massachusetts want a visionary, change-oriented governor, or is it a stay-the-course appetite in the Commonwealth?
So I think Tito hit on something, Councillor Jackson, really important, which is how do you connect with people? And I don't think that matters what office you held before, but frankly, sort of how going forward and during your time in office, you conveyed your humanity. And while folks have called Charlie a Governor Baker a mechanic, he's actually been able to forge those connections. And I think he's been a very smart and savvy politician. And so I think sometimes it's a lot more personality than we often like to admit. And certainly for those of us like me who've lost a race, that's a hard thing to admit. But people want to connect. You know, it's all the, I think we used to call it, Counselor, the beer test, right? Who do you want to go out and have a beer with on Saturday night? And I think that is probably more than the sort of model, almost as important as anything else. And I do, you know, to the earlier points, think that, you know, the emphasis on basketball, the emphasis on the, you know, roots growing up are, you know, smart strategic moves by the Attorney General.
Still with us this week, our panelists, Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical, and Jane Swift, president of Learn Launch, and of course, you. And we are now going to talk about the COVID shift. Cases diving off the cliff after climbing a cliff, but hospitals, schools, testing capacity still hurting badly. And now that new word, endemic, in our conversation. Do you know what it means? Do you think it's where we are? And what changes, if any, do you want to see in policy right now? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, Jane Swift, Tito Jackson, I'm going to start right off with some sound from a conversation we had with Dr. Ashish Jha this week, Dean of Brown University School of Public Health, who told us on Wednesday there is no clear end to this pandemic.
Every pandemic throughout human history has come to an end. There's an old phrase, that pandemics end with a whimper, not with a bang. And the idea is that pandemics fade. I mean, there will be a day where WHO comes out and announces this is over, but that's really not the day that matters. What matters is that more and more this pandemic will start fading into the background. And I think the beginning of that end has already begun with this Omicron surge and what comes ahead of us.
So, Jane Swift, food for the soul may be there, although wouldn't it be nice if you could just flip a switch, right, and have something end. But does it feel to you as if that's where we are in some waning or beginning to fade moment?
Well, I'm encouraged that folks like the expert you just had on, there was an article in the Globe earlier this week, are starting to talk about what we do next in this endemic stage. You know, I have been disappointed, frankly, for the last year that for all the sophistication and technological savvy of our society in this country, that we have really struggled to individualize and in some ways tailor our response with the tools at our disposal. So I think the endemic stage gives us, is coming. I do see it coming. And it gives us an opportunity for a reset where, we protect the people who are very vulnerable, by the way, to the flu, to many viruses, and to COVID. And we protect the institutions that can be overwhelmed if we have a surge. But at the same time, we also protect the individuals, whether they're children in our schools, college students who've had, you know, 3 years mostly of really unfortunate instruction that was never meant to be virtual or remote or so restricted, and all the adults and parents in particular who've had to absorb that. There are ways with smart governing and technology to handle the endemic phase and meet multiple different priorities at the same time.
So Tito Jackson in Boston, what are you hearing and seeing? Does it feel like we've started to move into an endemic phase? Does it feel like it's still the height of the surge? I'm mindful of all the different people we heard, medical experts nationally this week, say, listen, even when you've come off a peak, you have as many cases on the way down as you did on the way up.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like an endemic stage at this point in Boston. I have many friends, in particular those who are educators, who have gotten COVID and some who've gotten it for a second time. There's still testing that's going on in the schools that actually means that several young people are actually being sent home during those test taking times because they are positive. I think it's still a time for vigilance, and it's still a time for us to be very thoughtful and deliberate in what we're doing so that we can actually ride this down. I do believe that that level of caution is needed, and I believe that in the end, that will be the better way of going about doing things versus getting to a point that where we possibly could have another shutdown. Because I don't believe that businesses and the business community could really survive that.
So slightly different notes there from former Governor Jane Swift and former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In your community, do you feel like we're still in the middle of a surge, or does it feel like we're starting to turn towards something endemic? You know, something, this is what we live with now. Again, 1-800-423-8255. Jane Swift, picking up on Tito Jackson's last point there, I want to play a little sound from Larry Wolpe, Potter Road Elementary School principal in Framingham, talking with WBUR's Carrie Young.
6:12 on Thursday morning, January 13th, and sure enough, that first text came in from my assistant principal saying, hey, somebody's not coming in, so we're officially shorthanded. The struggle is real and it continues.
One of the things that's been on my mind a lot this week is the lag between, or the gap between, what you have to be planning ahead for and where you are right now, and how painful and hard it can be to have both conversations at the same time. You know, as a former public leader yourself, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and as you know, my organization, my nonprofit Learn Launch, works with a number of schools and districts and school and district leaders. And so the absences, and by the way, some is, you know, has been said, are because folks get the infection. And I have friends who are teachers who have gotten ill because of working from COVID. But also then you have all of this conflicting and confusing guidance around who should be quarantining after COVID enters your household or you have a close contact. So I think that one of the things we need to remember is, you know, the counselor's right. We are not in a major shutdown, but if you get a close contact or your child is sent home, you're for all intents and purposes in a shutdown mode. And that's the piece that I think some of these public health officials are saying we need to rebalance and think about. And I do believe there are safe steps that can be taken. And folks much smarter than me in public health have talked about how, with folks getting vaccinated and boosted, which is tremendously important, we can progress to those stages so we have fewer absences. I would say in schools today, this issue of teacher and other professional absences is by far one of the greatest stressors. And then for parents, children being at home and not having the opportunity to continue their learning, and frankly, parents not being able to continue to work if they can't work remotely, you know, those are stressors that may not be being felt by everyone in Massachusetts or America, but they're being felt very strongly by individuals who either contract the virus or are exposed to it.
So I'm mindful in the back of my mind as you're saying all of that. Excuse me. We have a lot of teachers who listen to the show. We also have a lot of healthcare workers who listen to the show. And many of the same things that you said on the school side could be said on the healthcare side. And we'll pick back up on that, too. I do, though, want to go to the phones for a minute here. 1-800-423-8255. We have Sarah on the line in Boston. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I have two points of clarification to make that I'm seeing mistaken quite a bit. The first is that a doctor does not equal public health, and nor does a politician. So when people are saying public health officials are saying something, very often it's actually a politician that is saying something. The other clarification that I want to make is endemic does not mean that people are not dying every single day. And these are people who may have other conditions, but they're not uncommon conditions. And we should not be taking it lightly that so many people are dying of COVID and be all excited that we're on the other side of the curve. We're still seeing record numbers of deaths across the country. Thank you very much.
So a harsh reminder from Sarah there, and this is underscoring the part I was just saying with Governor Swift, that is the challenge of having a forward-looking conversation in public policy, Tito Jackson, while you're still dealing with the reality of the moment. And we heard pushback from Sarah just there about that tension. She's talking about deaths, the experience in our hospitals, the strain on our healthcare system, the numbers of people who are still getting severely ill. And of course, we know the majority of the people who are experiencing hospitalization and death at this point are unvaccinated. Is that a point we need to be coming back to also and hammering on more?
It's not only it's a point, but it's also reality. I actually, in the last 2 weeks, lost two friends to COVID.
I'm sorry.
So this is still something. Yes, it's something that people are living with. It is also something that people are dying from. I think the other point that Sarah brought up that is actually very important is that the number of folk in the hospital currently based on COVID is also a stressor for the other conditions that you have. Right. So if you go there with a stroke or you go there with a heart attack or the like, you are not going to get the level of care that you actually should be getting based on the hospitals being well over their limits. And speaking of the political side of this, there was actually a change and modification in the law relative to malpractice, that you basically can't file a malpractice case right now. Based on the fact that we know hospitals are running well over the burden that they would normally have. And shout out to those first responders, those individuals who work in hospitals and in the healthcare arena. You've been there. You continue to show up for us. And the reason why we are also able to have folks not die at the rate that they have is based on the work that you do on a day-to-day basis, and we have to give you your props.
Yeah, you know, it makes me think of a conversation we actually had last week with Dr. Eric Dixon, who's the head of UMass Memorial Health. And he was on Ask the Doctors at the beginning. We asked him how he was doing, and he just laid out this staggering set of numbers about how this third surge has actually been the worst for them by quite a bit over the first two surges, and just how drained their healthcare system is. And it is an important reminder that we can also be coming down from a peak and in a surge, right, all at the same time. Former Massachusetts Governor James Swift, I'm going to play a little more sound here from our conversation this week with Dr. Ashish Jha. He is public health. He is the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health. And he told us on Wednesday that the next time something like an Omicron surge happens, we can be better prepared and we should be better prepared.
When the next surge comes, we'll be ready. We'll have masking for people who need them. We'll probably need masking for short periods of time, let's say next winter. We'll have tests widely available. We'll have more therapeutics. We're going to manage surges in the future much, much better if we do these things. We have got to stay focused like a laser on making sure we have all of these tools in plentiful supply. So whatever Mother Nature throws at us, we're going to be able to handle it.
In listening to that, I remember thinking that there are two underlying principles to that. One is, in fact, the ability to stockpile supplies like that. Two, the agility required to shift in terms of our policies and responses, and how often over the last couple of years, both in our Ask the Doctor segments, our public health segments, our We Can Review segments, the criticism has been we haven't been able to do exactly those two things, stockpile what we need and be agile. How do we get better at those things, Jane Swift?
Yeah, so every crisis, and I also just want to say to Sarah, I completely agree with all of her sentiments. And I think the other thing that Dr. Jha said is it's not just COVID, right? And that was one of the points from experience that I am trying to make. If you're an immune compromised person and you are exposed to some of these really brutal viruses, it's great when there's a vaccine. We have some that there are not a vaccine for yet. And we should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. Masking actually protects folks from a whole bunch of things. And I think that the way to get to that agility is to do some really good revisiting to what went well, what didn't. And in crisis leadership, we always say there is a time when you do reckoning and when you plan and prepare. You know, this was not the first ever pandemic, but it's the first one in 100 years. So there were very few people in leadership positions, none that I can think of, who had been through, you know, the 1918 flu or whatever the year was. So hopefully we will use the lessons learned to protect the most vulnerable who are at the greatest risk of dying and communicate more effectively to more quickly be able to get the public, because it's not just that we weren't agile, the public didn't pivot with us. And, you know, as much as we don't want political leaders making some of these decisions, they are the folks in a crisis that folks look to for leadership.
Tito Jackson, before I go to a break, just briefly, are we good at that kind of reflection and lesson learning here in the Commonwealth?
We need to get better. I think we need to make sure that we, as the governor brought up, learn these lessons. But I think the biggest lesson that we need to take is that we weren't set up for this in the beginning. There were inadequacies, there were gaps, and there were disparities that started. So when we talk about going back to the quote unquote new normal, well, normal actually meant that we had all of these disparities that existed prior. So we have to acknowledge those disparities. By the way, this is kind of what, this is actually what universal healthcare looks like, ladies and gentlemen. Everyone gets a test. We're not worrying about who's gonna pay for that test at this point, because by the way, if the governor sneezes on me and and she has the flu, then I'm probably going to get the flu. So that's one of the other components that we actually need to acknowledge here.
That was quite specific, Tito.
Well, okay, cool. But I know she would definitely cover her mouth. I know she'd be masked and she would definitely cover her mouth. But I do believe that there's a real opportunity to learn about the fact that we need to do for one another, and that healthcare and people's ability to receive healthcare is a basic fundamental human right. And I believe that this is shown even more today than it was prior to the COVID crisis.
Former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift and former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson. We're going to finish the Week in Review talking about if and how the voting rights debate in Washington comes home for you here in Massachusetts. Are you comfortable with the state of voting rights here in the Commonwealth? Do you feel they will be preserved and protected? Will you pay different attention to a race like the Secretary of the Commonwealth this year? That's the steward of voting in Massachusetts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join this conversation. Tito Jackson, how do you draw the connection between what happened in Washington this week and where we are in Massachusetts?
So, you know, it is very unfortunate that there are individuals who fix their mouths as well as their Twitter fingers to say and laud the name of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And then went ahead and desecrated his name by voting against measures that would allow for voting rights to be preserved, in particular for Black folk and people across our country. That is a very sad state of play. And when it comes to it, and this is on the Democratic side, you know, having Sinema and Manchin stand in the way of this progress is very, very problematic.
But excuse me for interrupting just a second. Kristen Sinema, Arizona, Democratic Senator, Joe Manchin, West Virginia, the two Democrats not in favor of changing filibuster rules.
Yeah,
go ahead.
But we still have work to do here. Election Day registration. I went to University of New Hampshire, and when I voted for Bill Clinton, one of my first presidential elections, I got to register to vote that day. You can actually open a bank account today and actually take money out of it. And so it baffles me that we don't have that. Early voting. This should happen in every single election, not only in the statewide elections or on special occasions for COVID. So I think one of the things that I would like to see is many of the aspects of COVID accommodations, that those be extended as the regular way that we do things. The bicameral Congress and many aspects of the building that Governor Swift used to preside over are the archetype of the U.S. democracy. So we should be leading and not following in this regard relative to voting and voter access in the state of Massachusetts.
So first, picking up on the first part of your comment there, Monday was Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Here's 13-year-old Yolanda Renee King, Martin Luther King Jr.'s granddaughter, who had a message from members of Congress on Monday.
The elected leaders out there who are tweeting, posting, and celebrating my grandfather, Dr. King, today, my message to you is simple. Do not celebrate. Legislate.
Governor Jane Swift, as you watched this unfold this week, how did you think about its resonance here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
So a lot of what I thought about is that 2 years ago, before the world shut down and I was teaching at BC Law, I taught an entire course on election security. And I think one of the many things that Donald Trump has ruined, both for the Republican Party and for the electorate in general, is we can't have a sophisticated, bipartisan, grown-up debate about election security. And the truth is, I just went quickly and grabbed my syllabus from those days. But, you know, we have had folks talking about election security since 2018, when American Progress released a report about the state of election security in 50 states. So there are actual issues around election security that have to be addressed. But the problem is that we are doing it in a way that undermines the integrity and the confidence that folks have, both in the fairness on one side and on the results on the other. And I would love to see a few statesmen stop trying to score headlines. Maybe this is Pollyanna of me. And let's have a real substantive debate about where there are issues and how we fix them, as opposed to another partisan mud fight, which I think, frankly, the public's done with.
So, Tito Jackson, I'm going to come back to you, and I'm just going to say, oh, man, I did it. I started us down this path, and we only have a few minutes. So you get one rebuttal, Tito Jackson, and then I'm sorry, but I'm going to probably move us forward.
Listen, both of us have been involved in multiple elections. I'm going to say it plain. The quote-unquote election fraud and the like, I believe it's a farce in terms of the actual election outcomes. The data does not play that out. And I think I really don't believe that these are real issues. What we're seeing are real issues where people are removing polls. So there are actual lines. They're removing drop boxes. And these are being done in largely Black communities. And I think it is notable that Republican Mitch McConnell made a distinction between African Americans and Americans. I think that train of thought is fraught with some of the action that is occurring. When Black folk come out and vote in record numbers, instead of applauding it, there is a willingness to dampen it, and dampen it from allowing people to pass out water, making that illegal, and making voting something that is our right and our most valuable franchise even harder for those individuals that should be able to vote. And we must stand on that if we're going to even fix our mouths to ever say the name Martin Luther King Jr. ever again.
Okay, so I'm going to skip our hubbubs. I do want to stay with this a minute longer. You just made reference to a statement by Mitch McConnell so people can hear it themselves. We actually have it. He is answering a reporter who asked, what would you say to voters of color who are concerned that without this legislation, it could become harder for them to vote?
Well, the concern is misplaced because if you look at the statistics, African-American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans. A recent survey, 94% of Americans thought it was easy to vote. This is not a problem.
So obviously the comparison language there immediately picked up on in social media. Governor Swift, I hear you about concern about election security. You hear Tito Jackson back saying, former Boston City Councilor, I've been in a number of races. That is not the thing. I do want to give you a chance for a final thought here on this.
So I think as technology advances, so this is the thoughtful piece, right? As technology advances, we need to continue to make sure we have integrity and we pay attention to voting, particularly when we have interference that's been documented in a bipartisan way by foreign sources. So having said that, I believe that Joe Biden won the last election. I agree with Tito. This is the issue, right? Like, people have to have confidence so we accept the results. And I agree with him that there have not been elections where the results have been determined by fraud. But I do think we should always be having legitimate public policy debates. And I also believe what Mitch McConnell said was abhorrent. I don't know if it reveals where his heart was or if he's just so darn old that he misspoke, but that's, for his constituents to decide. It was terrible and hurtful, I'm sure, to a lot of individuals.
So I just want to underscore, I love Week in Review because I always learn so much from being engaged in these conversations with our panelists, no exception, especially this last part here. You just heard former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, now president and executive director of Learn Launch, and former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson, now CEO of Verdant Medical. Really grateful to both of you for your time and your thoughtfulness today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So joining us now, we are going into the weekend. We try to bring you a little joy when we can. So we're getting a rundown of what this weekend is and what the opportunities are. WBUR Arts reporter Cristela Guerra. Cristela, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So it's great to have you. It is cold out. My knees were cold this morning. But let's start with something that fits that mood. Curling, not in Canada, but in Boston. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So curling, which is a sport that some know from the Olympics. It's in the seaport of all places, which is called it's called the Snowport right now, I guess, due to the snow and the activities that they have going this winter. You can learn the basics on Saturdays from the North End Curling Club on the Seaport Common, I believe. Lessons are 30 minutes. They're from 2 to 4. No experience necessary. Just dress warmly and RSVP online.
And just for listeners, curling, that's the one with the brooms and the disc and the thing that slides across the ice and everybody sweeps the ice, right? That looks
doesn't look very strenuous to me. It feels like you're mopping ice, but I'm not going to hate on the curlers out there. I feel like it's probably really difficult. I think we should all try it.
I think it looks super cool. I've always thought it just looks amazing. Okay, so that's an outside event. And we thought about this, Cristela. We thought really hard about do we bring back conversations about indoor arts activities given where we are. So I want to note we're being thoughtful about that. If you feel comfortable being indoors this weekend with a mask, I do understand that there is some music and art happening this weekend you want people to know about, right?
Yeah. This orchestra, I feel like, is very specific. It's an orchestra of people with mental illness and those who support them. They're called the Me Too Orchestra. They're performing a free concert on Sunday. It's called the Stigma Free at Boston Symphony Hall. I think we have one of their performances, actually.
So I'm hearing such a serene sound there. How long is the concert, and why am I hearing the horns and things in the background?
So the concert, it's going to go, I believe, for an hour.
I promise not to quote you on that.
Check my facts. But that's outside. This is a cut that was actually filmed outside. But on Sunday, the audience can enjoy the acoustics indoors.
Fantastic. What else do you have if one wants to be inside?
So if you want to be inside and actually get a really good workout, and I'm very biased because I think this is my favorite. I love Afro-Cuban. It's grounding. It's a gorgeous dance form. So instead of curling, because it's at the exact same time, you could go to Cambridge to the athletic club from 2 to 4. There's a workshop that explores movement. It's a dance form rooted in African traditions brought to Cuba. And it's taught by Aaron Dumas. And you can take it in person, but you can also do it online. So if you don't feel at ease being in a class or in a gym, you know, do it from your home virtually.
We have a little sound that I know you shared with us from the class. Let's listen to a little bit. And so what you're hearing is the music. You're hearing a little bit from the instructor. The video is fantastic. Each movement is named after an Orisha. Is that right? God or goddess of water? And the drumming, and Aaron helps explain the story and technique. Can you tell me a little more?
Yeah, so Afro-Cuban is rooted in a, you could be dancing a form that's Yemaya, which is the goddess of the ocean. You could be dancing Obatala. And these all are stories and mythologies from this specific ritual belief, which are African beliefs that were brought to Cuba. And it's beautiful. It's very centering. I actually do it quite a bit.
So what about someone who's not ready to move that way? Something maybe a little more still?
Art, Tiziana. Beautiful, contemplative art. In Newton Center at the nearby gallery are two remarkable Puerto Rican artists, Sebastian Gutierrez and Uciel Orlandi. They work with textiles. It's an exhibit called Tela para Cortar. The phrase is fabric to cut in Spanish. And it means to address or dwell on a topic, to really kind of unpack it. It's Saturday night, 6 to 9, and it's curated by the brilliant David Guerra. He's a Cuban curator and founder of Area Gallery.
All right.
Go ahead. That's Newton. And then in Gloucester at the Cape Ann Museum, that is a special exhibition. They're actually extending it through March 31st. It's called Cape Ann and Mohegan Islands Vistas, Contrasted New England Art Colonies. And their new works by artists, it's all very like out. It's almost, they've been painting the region, right? And it's an appreciation of the area. So new works by an artist, Ken Gore, Teresa Bernstein, Walter Farndon, Eric Hudson, Margaret Patterson, Charles Mulally, just local artists who are really appreciating kind of the landscapes.
All right, that all sounds like a lot of fun, Cristela. That's WBUR arts reporter Cristela Guerra. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. And we are going to go out now on a little music from The Strokes, this is the song Last Night. Boston Calling has released its headliners after losing Rage in the Machine just yesterday. But we now know they will have the Foo Fighters, The Strokes, and local favorites Miranda Ray, Van Buren, and others. So we'll go out with The Strokes. That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for listening to Radio Boston. Tune in again on Monday for Mondays with the Mayor. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu will join us, and we'll take your calls. Have a great weekend.